Hello and welcome to podcasts. Hang on a minute. What is that? I have just seen a pig fly past the window of our office. A flying pig. That can only mean one thing. There's been a new Debian release.
Hey.
Yay!
Yes.
Excellent.
Yes, brilliant.
And we'll be talking about that and celebrating that throughout this podcast. I'm Mike Saunders.
I'm Andrew Gregory.
I'm Efrain Hernandez.
And I'm Graham Morrison.
Brilliant. We're all here. The full team of Linux Format are here. So in this podcast, we'll be talking about Debian 6, KDE 4.6. We've got our discoveries of the week, our challenges. Andrew's in the dock to talk about GNOME, I believe, the open ballot, and much, much more. If you love everything we do, then you'll love our magazine, Linux Format, which you can subscribe to at tuxradar.com/subscribe.
Awesome work, Mike. As usual, we decided that after last episode, starting with the news was a bit of a downer.
It gets quite technical, doesn't it, early on? Yeah,
and it took us a while to kind of cheer up after the news stories. So we thought we'd push news back, so at least we can, you know, start with a bit of enthusiasm. Looking at it means it's DOTW GM,
right?
That's Discovery of the
Doctoral Operation of Tetrisovsky.
So we're going to start the podcast with our discoveries.
Excellent. Cool.
Which, considering we have all been really busy the last couple of weeks, it's going to be interesting.
True. Yeah, we have been making that magazine thing.
Yeah. So. Yeah. It's the excuse we always fall back on.
That's every 2 weeks.
I don't know. Anyone got a brilliant discovery? Maybe we should leave it till last.
I've got a brilliant discovery.
Hooray.
It's for the iPhone.
No! Where's Paul?
That's why he's not with us anymore.
I've got two brilliant discoveries, actually. No, yeah, kind of. Yeah, why not inflate it to 2.5 brilliant discoveries? The iPhone, there's now a Catholic iPhone app.
Really?
Yes. This is. I'm introducing this because I hope that it will be introduced to Android. That's the tenuous link.
I'm sure someone will create an Android version if we pray hard enough.
Yeah. It's an app that offers you absolution.
Absolution. I guess
it's a confession app. So you load it up and then you click on the buttons. So I don't know. I just read it in the Daily Mail. But the best thing is that it's been given. It says it's approved by the Catholic Church. It's actually been given its imprimatur, I think that's the right word, from Bishop Kevin Rhodes of the Diocese of Fort Wayne.
Fort Wayne.
So it's not actually, and it's been, it's not actually, you know, the Pope who's approved this.
I thought it was actually properly supported by the Roman Catholic Church, but it's just some dude in Fort Wayne.
Just some dude who's a Catholic bishop.
Wow. And he's an iPhone fan.
Did he develop the app by chance? Or get his son? No, he couldn't have got his son, could he? It sounds really good.
My other discovery, and perhaps somewhat more relevant, is the difference between Sue and Sue hyphen in Fedora. I've just been fiddling about with Fedora just a couple of minutes ago, and I've been trying to open a file as root, and obviously I typed in Sue and my password, thinking that would be enough, but. All, but it says, no, Sue. So Sue get it, grub.conf. It's like, no, you can't. You can't open this. And I said, why? But why not? I've entered my password.
I'm here.
Sue. And it's me. It's definitely me. It's definitely my machine. And I definitely installed Fedora myself not half an hour ago. And I had a look online. And I needed to put Sue hyphen because Sue just gives you root privileges in your home path.
Right.
But Sue hyphen gives you root privileges in throughout the whole file system.
Right. I didn't know that.
I don't know. I didn't know this. So if, on the off chance that you're getting stuck on this and haven't Googled it already, that's what's going wrong. I just find it a bit arbitrary. A bit sort of pointless that such a distinction would be made.
Yeah.
And is this just a Fedora thing? Or?
Well, as far as I can see, it's just a Fedora thing. I only just found it, you know, 15 minutes ago.
Right.
But I'm running Fedora virtualized on Mint, and when Mint, when you make a mistake on like that on Mint, Mint will tell you.
Yeah.
Like, oh, you can't open this. Are you root?
Yeah, that's true.
It will give you a suggestion of what to do.
I guess I always do su root just by kind of habit.
I just run as root all the time. Well, yeah.
You closet Linspire fan.
I'm still running Linspire.
Day with the day. That's a really Linux-centric discovery.
Well, I know.
Wow.
Thanks.
Makes mine kind of not so cool then.
This is where Linux and Catholicism collide.
Wow.
In my tiny mind.
Two things. Well, I discovered Mojibake, which is a Japanese word, which refers to that phenomenon on the internet when you try and view a page in a foreign language, but it doesn't have the code page settings correct. It doesn't have the symbol table sorted out. So you try and view a page that's in Russian or Japanese or Chinese, and it just comes up with empty boxes or squiggles, things like that. There's a German term for it as well, which is Zeichensalat, character salad.
Character salad?
Character salad, yeah.
That's lovely.
Which is really cool. But we've all seen this. We've all come across pages where the encoding's all messed up.
If only I were bilingual, yes, I would have done. It just looks like foreign to me.
But there's, on the Wikipedia page for this Mojibake, there's a fantastic photo of a package that was sent to somebody, and I'll try and do my best to describe it here, but we'll put the link in the podcast notes. But a girl in France had wanted to send a book to her friend in Russia, so she asked her Russian friend to send the address in Moscow or wherever, where she lived, back to her. So the Russian girl sends her address back, but because the encoding's all wrong, it doesn't come back as Russian Cyrillic characters. It comes back as strange squiggles, like I's with umlauts above and A's with those Danish circles above and things like that. But the French girl didn't know this. She just assumed these were Russian characters. So she wrote this address down on the packet with all these crazy messed up characters, sent it to Russia, and some Russian postal worker corrected it.
Whoa!
Some super elite Russian guy in the mailroom. He went through all the letters and wrote the real address over the top of it.
Хорошо.
Absolutely brilliant. The Russian term for this phenomenon is «Krakozyabri». Which I haven't pronounced very well. I can only say about 30 Slovak words, so I'm not very good with Slavic languages, but it's brilliant. That's so cool. So there is hope in the world.
That does sound great, yes. Yeah. Excellent. Well, my discovery is a consequence of me doing a KDevelop tutorial thing. KDevelop's the KDE IDE, AKDE IDE, because you can also use Nokia's Qt Creator. But anyway, it doesn't have any templates to get you started with the project. It has none. It actually has some Qt ones, which is a bit silly. So when you start up the application and you want to create a quick web browser or even just a window where you're going to drop widgets in, you have to start completely from scratch, which is really arcane in IDE terms. Almost every IDE I've used for the last few years has come with a nice set of templates. And if you look at Xcode, which is a poor example of an IDE that has hundreds of them. But this discovery is that there's a supporting application, nothing to do with KDevelop, called KApp Template, a standalone application that bundles dozens of templates for KDE applications and creates them. And they are compatible with KDevelop, so you can just import them. So you can create Plasma widgets, you can create those little runtime command things from the top of the window and do all that really interesting KDE stuff and get started working with KDE without using KDevelop. And it's insane that it isn't part of KDevelop already. But that's my discovery, KApp Template.
Wow, KDE and insanity shock.
I know. I still love it, guys.
Just.
Well, yeah, my discovery of the week was I discovered a new Mexican restaurant in Bristol. It's called Mission Burrito.
Mission Burrito.
And technically speaking, it's not a restaurant, it's a taqueria. Well, now let me try to explain this.
Like Taco Bell?
Almost. It's very close.
So they do
but not quite.
Authentic chimichanga restaurant.
Yeah, exactly. Note. A taqueria is, in Mexico, it's a taco shop. Basically, you go to a
Taco Bell.
Fast. Yes, Graham. Taco Bell. You go to a fast food sort of place and eat tacos of all kinds of fillings. It could be chicken, it could be pork, it could be whatever, ham, whatever. A burrito, technically speaking, is a flour tortilla rolled with cheese and ham. That's the original one. And effectively, it's a Californian invention. Because in that region, corn doesn't grow, so therefore they have to do the tortillas with flour rather than with maize.
Is that why they're so hard?
What, the Taco Bell shells? No.
Is that because they're refried?
It's just because they're rubbish.
They seem impossible to eat. Yeah. You just bite into them and they shatter, so everything falls out. If it's soft, then it's...
That is why you have to have an authentic tortilla to enjoy Mexican food. Otherwise, in Mexican. Anyway, the reason why I discovered this place is because I recently started with another friend a Mexican Bristolian Society in Bristol.
Cool.
And we're going to have our first meeting in Mission Burrito.
So to join, you have to be Mexican
Not necessarily. No, you have to be either Mexican or Bristolian or a Mexican from Bristol.
Right.
But we're honorary Mexicans, aren't we?
Yeah, you are. You are part of the gang. So
I think we should go to this place.
I think we should go and try it. The first meeting is going to take place this Saturday coming. So there you go. It's lunch. Mission Burrito. There you go.
I think you should invite Federico Mena
and Steve Coogan
and Miguel Diaz Casa.
I should really. Because would they be Mexicans available?
They wrote no.
And it could be the Mexican Bristolian Linux using society as well.
Well, that's my discovery of the week.
Thanks.
That's brilliant.
We can all be indolent, flatulent, sit around staring at goats and eat refried steak
with cheese on top.
It's not racist, it's just a joke.
And so we can now delve properly into the news. And of course, as we mentioned in the opening to the podcast, Debian 6 has been released. Woo!
That's
about 2 years after Debian 5.
Wow!
Yeah, which is not bad for the Debian team.
Brilliant.
It's...
Yes, it's really good. I'm really hot in here. It's got GNOME 2.3. GNOME 2.3.0
and it's got OpenOffice 3.2.
yeah,
so it's fairly up to date. And you know, all jokes about Debian's slow release cycles aside, the reason for that is its feigned stability. It is incredibly well tested. You know, the quality assurance procedures that all packages have to go through are very very demanding. So one of the things that confuses me is the choice of theme. Have you all seen the kind of spaceship theme that they've used?
No, I haven't. No.
It's all the way from the boot screen through Splashy and or Plymouth or whatever boot up sequence they use, through to the GDM login screen, through to the desktop. It's all done with these kind of cartoon spacecraft and stars and things like that. Now, it looks really good, but it makes it look like one of those edutainment distros. It makes it look like something from G Compris. Or
is it to do with Toy Story, because their code names, their release code names, are based on characters from Toy Story?
They are, aren't they? Yeah, like that's this one really is Squeeze, this release.
Is
before
Squeeze
that it was
kind of
Lenny. They're all, I don't know, but they're all characters in Toy Story.
What is Squeeze?
Toy Story,
do you know what Squeeze is?
I can't remember.
I've seen Toy Story a dozen times, but...
It might be Toy Story 2, or there was a third one as well.
I haven't seen the third, though.
Nope, haven't.
Squeeze.
Who knows? Well... We'll find out. Somebody will let us know in the comments.
Didn't they have those two green aliens in one of the films? I think it's the first one. In the arcade.
I saw the first one a billion years ago, so I can't really remember. But anyway, I wonder, you know, Debian's got this reputation for being a no-nonsense distro, the kind of thing you can roll out in your enterprise and it'll be supported for years and it simply will not break. And yet when you look at it now, it looks a bit like a toy distro. I mean, it's still quite polished, but it just looks strange. It doesn't have that appearance.
Maybe those people just won't care. You know, they don't use it for its aesthetics. So, you know, it's just something that's memorable or something distinctive for the latest release. I don't know. I should have looked, actually. But I really like Debian. I have run Debian in the past, and I'm not running it now. But
I can see myself moving to Debian full-time with Ubuntu, making all these random changes.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely right. Yeah.
I can can see, you know, Mint becoming the default, a standard kind of desktop distro of people, and Ubuntu more for the hardcore users who just want a reliable platform.
Because isn't Mint moving to Debian as a base?
They have a rolling release based on Debian, yeah, which was probably based on SID, or Unstable, or Experimental, or something.
Yeah.
But we're all glad to see it anyway, and it'll be on Linux format, cover disk 143 as well.
Brilliant.
Moving on, KDE 4.6 was released. I don't know much about this, but I'm sure you can fill us in, Graham, on all the juicy features.
KDE 4.6. We've done quite a few of these KDE releases, and I always say something like, and finally, it's more stable and usable, and now you can all abandon KDE 3.5. And 4.6 is... there are two releases a year now, so it's a bit like Ubuntu. There's nothing massively significant. There's kind of refinements to the Plasma activities. Activities are like virtual desktops, but groups of virtual desktops.
Whoa.
So you could have one for working, for example, or you could have one with loads of games. So you could switch between the games and working when people walk by your desk.
But you've always had virtual... We've always had virtual desktops since VTWM, haven't we? What does this do differently?
What it is, it is just like a group of virtual desktops, and the desktop configuration specific to what they call an activity. So you have your virtual desktops, you have your panel in a certain place, you have your icons on the desktop, you have your widgets on the background. That is an activity. You could save that as an activity and create a new one.
Ah, so when you...
Different panel, right. Different widgets.
So it's not just about the applications running in there. You can have an entirely different desktop
setup. Completely reconfigure the view, so you could have it, you know, tailored for full screen tile viewing of applications if you wanted on one. You could have, you know, small web browser windows on another.
That sounds pretty cool because, yeah, often when you're programming, you want to use a lot of tiled windows, whereas for browsing and stuff, you want full screen.
And I use one activity for screenshots. So it's a very, very simple background that I change occasionally, and I have another one for my usual work, so that when I switch to make screenshots, I don't have the page littered in icons and menus and other things running. Right. But they've had activities for a while. 4.6 adds the ability for an application to automatically load on a specific activity. So, with some virtual desktop managers, you can get applications to load on desktop 3. Uh-huh. Now it can load on desktop 3 of your screenshots activity.
Right. That sounds pretty cool.
Yeah.
Quite hardcore, but pretty cool.
The other thing that I've noticed is the fact that you can search meta tags within Dolphin. So there's the Dolphin is the file manager, and the panel on the right-hand side, although you can move it, you can search for through all your files for metadata that might be contained within an image, such as the name of the date the photograph was taken or anything else. Because this is, I don't know, it's not that interesting, I suppose, but part of KDE's semantic desktop experience, as they call it, is to do with the fact that you can rate and you can comment files on your desktop arbitrarily. All this information is contained within KDE. And when you rate and comment on files on your desktop, you can then search through this using Dolphin now, using the meta tag viewer thing on the right hand side. I don't use it, but you can't avoid it when you open Dolphin unless you close it.
That's interesting. I mean,
and they've not messed anything up.
Files. Can you rate like user bin files better then?
They're thinking about your media content, so photos, music, documents.
Right, so it transcends the actual media player then.
Yeah.
You know, you can rate your music in a lot of music playing applications and music managers.
I mean, it's just a 5-star rating, so you could give it volume or a quality. You could mean anything you want it to.
Right.
I don't know. At least they haven't messed anything up.
It does seem stable.
Yeah, I am using it. I had to use it to get the latest KDevelop.
I've got to admit, I'm starting to change my attitude towards KDE. I don't think I will run it, or at least not for a long time, but I think it's quite nice to know that something that powerful is there. I've always thought about it from my viewpoint, thinking, well, I find it always too cluttered and fiddly for me. I like XFCE. I like that kind of simplicity.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's nice to know that there is this desktop. If I have a really specific demand, like you were describing with all these activities, then I could set it up one day.
I think, I don't know. I mean, I do, I've got Puppy on my netbook. I've got Fedora still installed at home. I'm running GNOME, which I really like as well. I love the simplicity of their design. And I still kind of prefer KDE, you know. As we've talked in the past, I still think it's a massive duplication of effort. But, you know, they're all very different desktops, so...
Moving on, Mozilla, the Mozilla team has announced that they are going to ship 4 Firefox releases, four major Firefox releases this year, Firefox 4, 5, 6, and 7. Now, this is a pretty rapid departure from their previous release planning, where they've been on 3.x for...
Is this trying to be like Chrome?
Well, something? I wonder.
Well, yeah, are they going to be major releases, or will there be same standard incremental slight improvements but with proper version numbers?
This is what it,
version numbers that the man in the street can understand, rather than 3.8575 beta RC4.
Yes, I mean, they will still have to have point releases for bug fixes. Every time you fix one bug, you can't just increment the version number. I mean, I think there are a few programs like that, like Xterm or Less, which are both at version 482, or something like that.
It sounds like madness to me.
It does sound like a bit of version number envy, because Chrome's at 9, IE is at 9 now, is IE 9 out? And
also, most of us don't know what version number Chrome's at. Mm. Maybe that's what they're getting at. Maybe they're wanting people to install Firefox, and it's not going to become that important what version you've got. You just have to install it and keep up to date.
Keep up to date, if you are keeping up to date, yeah, that's, you know, for support purposes and documentation purposes, it does help to have a number.
Under what circumstances would you not be able to keep Firefox up to date if you didn't have an internet connection?
No, that wouldn't make any sense. No, I'm just thinking of the way the updating methods are fractured between distributions and Firefox's own method. I know Firefox can update itself, but I think that's grayed out in some distributions where distributions try to update itself. So if you end up having a problem, or you end up installing a new version from their site and it can't update itself because it thinks you've got a package manager.
Look at Debian, for example, with IceWeasel. You know, what would they do?
IceWeasel, exactly, yeah. So, but one of the interesting points they've made on their roadmap, and I really like this, they've said they want upcoming releases to always respond to user action within 50 milliseconds. MS, is that milliseconds?
That is, yeah.
50, which I think is fantastic, because we're all getting used to the speed of Chrome, the reaction. We're using tablet devices. If you look at iOS, everything responds to immediately when you touch it. You don't seem convinced, Graham.
I just think it's really easy to say you want everything to respond to 50 milliseconds, which I think would be a 20th of a second. It's going to be impossible for them to guarantee that's the experience users are getting. You know, because of Linux, because we discussed, there's no hardware acceleration that they can rely on. Maybe on Windows and OS 10 they can get it, but I guess what they mean is they want to give the impression that it's responding, because often what these things do is fake it. But
yeah,
it's a nice idea.
I think it's an honorable goal.
I'd rather see them reducing the UI. I mean, as they've got sketches on their website for the roadmap, I think that's more important, because
it looks quite Chrome.
It's looking rather, but it's looking rather old fashioned now, I think, in the face of IE, which is looking quite nice.
I haven't even seen IE 9. I haven't seen a single screenshot of it.
It's taken a lot of inspiration from Chrome.
Right.
And Chrome, obviously, which, if you don't have the window border on, is a really nice looking browser.
Yes. Yeah. So,
I don't know.
Hmm. I guess we'll see. But a faster Firefox is going to be good for everybody.
Yeah.
And then Android 3, there are rumours circulating that Android 3 Honeycomb is going to be a tablet-only operating system, and that Google aren't going to release it for mobile phones. They say that some of the features might trickle down, but it looks like, as we record this, it looks like there's going to be Android 2.x carrying on for mobile phones and Android 3.x for tablets.
That seems crazy.
Just seeing fragmentation quite early on.
It's also, it's even if everything is mutually compatible and non-fragmented and as far as possible, it means that it will be very hard for people, for companies selling Android-based phones, to say this is the latest version of Android, because it blatantly won't be.
That's the point. Yeah.
Whether if it's got all the same features of Honeycomb and more, it will still be Android 2.something.
Yeah.
Whereas someone might have Android 3 on their tablet.
People will get confused. Those people who've been told by their fellow geek, you must get the phone with the latest Android on, they'll go and ask for it. Yeah.
So, oh, well, I can't. Well, I'll just sit and wait then. Or I'll go over the road and get an iPhone.
Hmm.
Yeah, I think it's a mistake as well. The thing is that we don't know anything about Honeycomb other than pre-baked videos from CES. I'm surprised that the fragmented approach has worked so well for Android. I mean, you don't know what version of the OS you're going to get. you don't know whether the manufacturer or your network provider is actually going to update it. And yet, it's still the biggest smartphone OS now.
Yeah.
So maybe Google doesn't care. Maybe Google just wants low point of entry. They've decided that actually maintaining compatibility in some kind of 3.0 reference for both smartphones and tablets isn't worth their effort and not worth the outlay, and they're happy to go for the mid-market and leave Apple to iOS, you know, sharing. I don't know. I don't like it. I don't like spending money on something that I don't know. If I buy an app on Android, is it going to work on my tablet? I'm not too keen on buying it both times.
I saw this recently. I went to the Android market, the new web store for the Android market, the first time I've ever been there, and I clicked on a game. I can't remember what it was. And this was the first game I clicked on, and then I looked down at the reviews, and the first review I saw was somebody very angry saying he'd bought this thing and it didn't work on his Dell Streak or something like that.
Yeah.
And that was the very first thing I clicked on. I didn't have to hunt for hours to find an example of this Android fragmentation causing people headaches. It was the first thing I saw.
Yeah.
And that kind of user experience, that's going to be tough. I don't know what Google can do about it apart from to try and override the handset makers and say we can ship out updates to these phones whenever we want, but the handset makers aren't going to allow that. But then the handset makers need Android because they're not going to go with Windows Phone 7 so quickly, and they can't use iOS.
And it's only part of the problem because the hardware specification for each device is different. Screen resolution, aspect ratios, input methods, all of these things are so different across tablets and smartphones that maybe that's good what Google thinks. You know, this is where we're strong in the fact that it's just such a diverse area.
Yeah. You
know, so we just keep pushing out new versions and features. I don't know.
And with such Android optimism, we come to the halfway point of this podcast. Still coming up, You Dare Us. We've got Andrew Gregory, the Reverend Andrew Gregory, in the dock, and our open ballot.
Brilliant. It's that time for the section that dare not speak its name. Oh, you dare us.
Make it stop.
No,
it burns.
About this. No, I genuinely had.
Really? Even when I reminded you earlier today?
Yeah, when we were all really busily planning ours and, you know, drawing out roadmaps and mind storms.
Brain... Oh, no, it's mind waterfalls. Mind,
yes.
Now, politically correct. What? Huh? So I've written that 5,000-line kernel patch for nothing.
Oh, I know. This is bad, isn't it? Is this the worst one we've been at? I know there's been a couple of others that we've been.
What was it again?
It's not the worst one, but it is going to be. It's hard, but it's not bad.
What was it again? Should we remind the listeners?
We've accepted the challenge to make a contribution to an open source project.
Right.
And we've also written here, we're busy finishing the magazine, but we have lovely plans to make people happy.
That's 100% true.
Exactly. Our plans are in a fairly advanced stage.
Like any old SourceForge project.
Exactly.
The best part.
In true open source fashion, we are planning, and we're planning for different things rather than working together.
Yeah. There's going to be no cooperation here.
Yeah.
Actually, I spent quite some time looking... because I've been learning German, and I speak it to a reasonable degree now, I've been looking for German-only software projects to translate into English, and I found nothing, because most young German people speak pretty decent English, and most young German computer geeks speak very good English, so it's kind of hard to do that. I did look at the ZSNES source code to see if I could translate that into German. And all the text strings in that are hard-coded into some assembly files, which is completely awesome, but that means it's not very easy to make a patch. Well, I could make a patch, but, you know, it would break all the time.
It would be a fork.
It would be a fork, basically, and I cannot go around doing that. Not to my favourite piece of software ever. Kudos,
ZSNES.
Mike Snez,
awful. I did have... we've been really busy.
We are on magazine deadline, in fairness,
But I was actually going to... Before we decided to delay it 2 weeks, which is what we're going to do, I had actually spent a lot of my spare time trying to program a Behringer MIDI controller to access the MIDI SID box thing I was talking about a couple of weeks ago. And I got quite a long way into doing that. It's quite complicated, boring as well. But I was going to finish that template and make it available to the community, because those MIDI boxes are really cheap. Lots of people have them, and lots of people want one of those controllers for those little boxes because they only have three twiddly knobs on, and a Behringer BC2000 has lots. Just counting them up in my head, 32, maybe 32 with lots of buttons. So it kind of gives you hands-on control, but I didn't finish it. And also, it's not in the true spirit of what it was we were supposed to be doing, I know. Do you have any ideas?
Effie, you had a plan, didn't you?
Yeah, after looking at various icons and distribution logos, came to the conclusion that I should contribute on redesigning a logo for a distribution. And some of the logos that I saw, they do look like corporate identities. Some of them look quite amateur, some of them look quite professional, but I think that the worst one is Crunchback Linux. I think I should make a contribution to that, to redesigning, or to, I don't know, give ideas. So
you're going to use your art editor skills to turn Crunchbangs, what is it, a hash mark and an exclamation mark?
Yeah, that's what it is. And it's just, basically, it seems like someone just typed it and increased the size of the, the size of the font, and there you go. There you go, I got a logo. And I think it could look a little bit better, probably. So,
are you thinking of all the things that all the essential elements of an open source brandy, like people hugging to share the community and a penguin? Hugging a penguin.
I'm trying to be a bit more adventurous than that.
Get away from
the penguins. But I suppose what I have to do more research. I have to basically use Crunchback Linux and then see what it looks like and see how it feels like, and then sort of make a move on starting designing it. So that's going to be my contribution, redesigning Crunchback Linux logo.
That'll be cool.
That sounds like the most valid effort.
Yeah. I might switch to just making a logo instead.
That sounds pretty good. I plan to make a deb and or RPM of something which does not already have one. Because when you look through the hotpick section, you'll often find that, you need to compile this, you need to download this, you need this dependency and that dependency. And there's no point everybody doing that. And you might as well just get one person to do that and package it up.
Package management was that simple.
So, I'm learning from the best because I've found a tutorial that you wrote in there. So if I fail, I'll be able to just blame you.
That was probably 4 years ago.
it was 3 years ago. What year is it now?
That one before the world ends.
Yeah, 4 years ago. 4 years, yeah.
Yeah.
Was that RPM?
You did RPM and you did deb as well.
Did you do Slackware? Because that's nice and easy. It's basically a tarball scripts.
I just did debs and RPM. RPM is a lot easier.
Right.
If you want some advice.
Thanks, Graham. I might just do that instead.
Although the worst was auto package. Don't even talk about that.
I was thinking of going back along a few recent hot picks and finding something that looks pretty good to me. I like the look of Viking, which is sort of GPS geocaching mapping software. But if any listeners have any ideas of something that they'd like turned into a deb, then I'm quite happy to tilt at those windmills.
Unless it's got 800 different dependencies, and then you'll be able to make a deb for like the latest Ubuntu release or the latest Debian release, but it won't necessarily work on other deb based distros. That's part of the problem, because they have different library numbers, different library versions and things, so but good luck anyway.
Well, thanks. It sounds much better idea than mine anyway.
And mine.
Well, we'll all learn something.
Yeah.
Which is the main thing.
If you find a program that you're going to package up into a deb that doesn't have a German translation,
wow,
I can contribute that at the same
and
time.
And doesn't have a logo.
Yeah. Wow. And doesn't have, what are you doing?
Doesn't have weird audio knobs to twiddle.
Yeah, it could be the next version of Meek. My music sequencer.
There we go. Yeah. Has that got a logo?
No, it hasn't got a logo. It hasn't got any dependencies either.
No dependencies?
Well, no, it's just a script for Chuck.
Oh, right, okay.
So,
yeah, you can't create an executable from it.
Well, let's none of us get carried away and forget that we don't actually get paid for the podcast or its attendant homework. So we're obviously not going to go mental.
This is all free, listeners. Yeah. Enjoy.
Right,
It's now the next section.
That's my favourite section.
This is my favourite section too. In the dock. Just thinking about it, it could be any kind of dock. It could be the GNOME dock. It could be the KDE panel dock. It could be Julian Assange's dock. But no, this dock of ours, it gives Andrew Gregory 1 minute to try and convince the world.
Need some sort of countdown timer.
That something he believes true really is true. And
just like that.
This something for today's episode is GNOME or GNOME?
GNOME.
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 So Andrew has a minute to convince us that GNOME is the best desktop environment you could possibly want to use. Yeah. You ready?
Yeah.
All right. Should we count down?
Shall I do a countdown?
Yeah, why not?
3, 2, 1, go!
GNOME is the best because it was made by Mexicans. It was made by Miguel Diacaza and Federico Mena ages ago. And that makes it cool. That makes it a counterpoint to the Anglo-centric, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant hegemony that is ruining open source. I like it because it doesn't, it's just there. It doesn't try to get in the way or do anything clever. It's really, really boring. Install GNOME and you'll look at it and go, what? What have I just done? There's probably nothing there to it. There are no bells, no whistles. It doesn't do anything special or clever. It's just in the background. And that's what a desktop should be. It doesn't have glitzy 3D animations. It doesn't have hardware acceleration yet, although that will come in with GNOME Shell, but enough of that later. It's simple, it just works, it lets you get on with what you want
Five,
to do.
4.
What, oh?
3.
Oh, sorry, great. Mike's just put me one. Off by counting.
What would you have said in those 5 seconds?
I probably just sort of dissed KDE and XFCE.
You should have finished that with Viva Lint. Viva el Nom.
Viva el Nomo,
el Nomo,
I think it is.
El Nomo. Sorry, yeah, I completely forgot my language.
That sound of paper shuffling means only one thing. It's the printout of the comments section from Open Ballot. This fortnight we asked, do you plan to go to a Linux event this year? Do we plan to go to a Linux event this year, or is that dependent on the budget which has not yet been set?
I think so.
Oh, Graham, I'd really like to attend an event in Munich and Iceland and Salzburg, please. Yeah.
I'd quite like to go to an event in Mexico.
Me too.
Yeah.
You know what, the Languedoc, the regional government of Languedoc-Roussillon keep writing to me to tell me about their data centres. I'm dying to go and look at them.
I know you've always loved data centres.
Especially the ones in Languedoc. Anyway, the first honourable mention on this this open ballot subject must go to Torwag, who says, yes, I do. That is, go to a Linux event this year. Yes, I do, every single day. Basically, there are 4 possible day-by-day events. 1, resume my laptop, Linux event. 2, use my desktop PC, Linux event. 3, log in my server machine, Linux event. Use my Android phone, something like a Linux event. He goes on to say, you need to be more specific. Do you plan to attend any socialising Linux event which requires physical attendance?
Well, not if he's going to any of them. Yeah. I'd hate to meet someone like that. It sounds like a real-life Mr. Logic. That's horrible.
It's a pity that resuming your laptop is such a Linux event, though, really. I mean, it should just be effortless that you don't even notice it.
Yeah, that's true. So, yeah, pedantry aside.
Pedantry aside, we're trying to get in touch with Richard Stallman to interview him and find out his views on many diverse and fascinating things.
GNU/Linux format.
So that's that's ongoing. So I'd love to say yes, I definitely am attending that.
We've got to go to some things, surely.
We have.
I don't know. I don't know.
Well, one of the things we were talking about is hosting our own event, a reader roundtable, and we're planning this for two or three issues away. So it's still swirling around in our heads at the
moment.
We have
to go and try all the pubs in Bath and Bristol to be able to work out which is going to be the best venue.
Exactly. We've got to test all the beer for poison as well.
Yeah, that's true.
So, but once we have some sort of concrete idea, I'll put it up on TuxRadar and linuxformat.com. So you can come and join us.
So at least we can go to that.
Yeah, this is true. And we will host it for you.
That's good. Fosdem, mentioned by Fab from Linux Outlaws. Hello.
Hey, hello, podcast brethren.
But apparently we are way too late. You already did Fosdem.
Too late.
Sorry. Too late asking that question. Ed Morgan is going to Odd Camp. P Anonymous Anguish is going to the Odd Lug Down the Pub. Les Quarter Pounder will be running an event in Manchester on the 2nd of April called U Cubed. The event is aimed at Ubuntu, Debian, and Debian-based distributions.
Les Pounder's a pretty cool guy, isn't he? As far as I'm aware.
Yeah,
he helps out with our lug pages sometimes in the magazine.
He does, and I think there's going to be an advert for that particular event in the next issue of the magazine. So there'll be more information in there
for U Cubed.
Mm, yeah.
So that when does that next issue go on sale? That must be about the week, a week or two before.
Yeah.
4 weeks when this podcast goes out. No, something like that.
But in plenty of time for the event, though.
It is. I did check that. So, yeah.
Okay. Cool. Miska, Lucky Miska, says that he was at Fosdem, he's attending some Czech events, Linux Expo Install Fest, he's going to be at the Chemnitz Linux Tag, probably the Berlin Linux Tag as well, he's going to be attending OSS Conf in Žilina.
In where?
Žilina.
Žilina, that's in Slovakia, I'm sure of it, that's cool.
Oh, Žilina then. Sorry.
I guess.
Frostcamp in Zurich, Linux Alt in Brno, what an international ninja.
Brilliant. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I'd like to go over there. I'd like to go to Chemnitz.
Chemnitz, is that Karl Marx stat, as was?
It is, indeed.
If only they'd kept that big statue of Karl Marx, that always looks great. sadly, Barry Van will not be attending any such gatherings because he lives in Perth, which is in Western Australia, the most isolated city in the world.
Is it really the most isolated?
Well, that's what he says, and I'm in no mood to question.
There's a Perth Linux user group, though. I mean, they could, you know.
That's true. They could. There's no excuse. Somebody here from Ireland says that he's not going to attend anything because it's so hard to get there. And there's also someone from China who says I'm a junior school student in China. I love Linux, but it's impossible to take part in any Linux event.
I would imagine that there are actually a few people in China. Yeah. I've heard that there are quite a few people there.
You'd think that there's a critical mass of more than maybe 20 Linux users in China.
In 1.3 billion people, yeah. So
I'd hope so.
Yeah, and with all their super fast maglev trains now, they can all meet one another in about 3 seconds. So
it sounds there's actually a massive variety of things when you look at it, because I've always thought, especially here in the UK, that there isn't really a big event that we can all get behind and all go and enjoy. But there have been over the last 18 months or 2 years events like the one Les Pounder is helping to organise that are on a smaller scale, usually in community centres, usually not just Linux, but you know, a bit of hackery, a bit of installing things, a bit of talking and socialising, and I think that's brilliant. So
yeah, I read about Odd Camp recently because I think Howard Neil Bothwick went there with our freelancers, and there was no organisation by the looks of it. It was just a place where geeks met one another. You didn't even have to register, you just turned up,
brought
a computer if you wanted to.
There was no agenda,
no nothing, so you just meet up with some other geeks, hackers, computers, and say, yo, should we all, you know, play a game of this, or should we contribute together on that, or go on IRC and troll people, whatever you want to do then.
Yeah.
That's like a musician's corner in an Irish pub, isn't it?
Exactly.
Pretty
much
like that. That's fantastic.
Odd Camp and U Cubed get a few mentions here, actually. Spiffy Tech, Asmodee, and Heed are all going to Odd Camp. This really, we didn't really think this one through, did we? To be honest, this open ballot.
What? Unlike all the other open ballots.
It's not as if there are any trends that we can pick out of the responses here. It's just yes, and I'm going to this one, or...
Well, actually, you're right, but we thought it would be good to kind of judge, not so much demand, but interest, to see what people were doing, seeing if it was important. And you know, there's been quite a few responses, and there's a lot of diversity in what people are doing. And I think the conclusion is that, rather than a negative conclusion that we sometimes have at the end of an open ballot, is that it's quite healthy if you're willing to put the effort into it yourself.
It might encourage people to set up their own small shows like this, because there used to be big shows where all the enterprise data server silo people would turn up, and they would be phenomenally boring. But these smaller events,
I think it's all part of what David Cameron likes to call the big society,
right?
And it's great to see people doing that kind of thing off their own back. And
let's write to him.
Write to him and tell him what how big our society is. Chen says August Penguin is the annual Israeli FOSS community event. It's been going every year since 2003, which really cocks a snook at all you people in Ireland and China who say that there aren't many events there. If there isn't an event, start one up.
Yeah, I'm going to look and see if there's a Siberian Linux users group, because if there's one there, anything's
bound
possible.
Bound to be. Joe Clemmer raises an interesting point. I am disabled and have a hard time leaving the house, so unless there's a Linux event in my living room, I'll be absent this year again.
I wonder what we can do then for disabled users.
Well, there are...
webcasts, something like that?
Yeah, I was going to say, plenty of conferences have webcasts, don't they? The Ubuntu or the GNOME Developers Conference always streams things.
They seem to be pretty bad at getting that kind of thing working live. I mean, it sometimes takes them months to even get the videos up of the presentations they've done. Sometimes you'll see the keynote live, and it's a bit of a shame actually that some of the big conferences like Linux World and OzCon only stream stuff commercially, so you have to pay for it to be able to access the stuff.
That kind of sucks.
That's something that they could do.
I did see that some project in the next couple of months is going to have a release party, an announcement in Second Life. I think it's for OpenSUSE 11.4.
Wow.
I think there's going to be a Second Life release party for that. So anybody can presumably turn up with their avatar that it doesn't resemble them in the slightest and jump around.
Is there a page on the internet that says what upcoming events there are for Linux stuff?
I haven't read this page.
A million such pages.
Yeah, I mean, after writing the user group pages for years, I don't think there is one. And, with all the results of what people have said, maybe we could quickly copy and paste that onto a page and kind of keep it semi-up-to-date on Tux Radar. That's something we could do.
Yeah, but there are all these things going on, and I can't think of a central resource for one. A central calendar of...
I mean, if you find yourself with a weekend free in March and you want to see what's going, what's happening, you think, I can go there.
Yeah. That's a really good idea. That could even be a contribution.
Hey, that could be mine.
Sorry, Andrew. Well, could you do that?
I could do that. Yeah, I'd be really happy to do that.
Brilliant.
You could do the lug pages in the magazine if you wanted.
They keep pulling me back in. I've enjoyed all the conferences I've been to. It's always a really unique experience. There are people that are far too geeky for me, but there are also people I always get on with, and I really enjoy going to them. It's a pity we don't get the chance to go to more of them.
Yeah.
Well, that's...
Or the budget is the truth.
The budget is the truth, yeah. I mean, we would love to go to California and FOSDEM and all of these things.
Yeah.
Linux Tag sounds really cool.
Is that the one in Germany?
That's the one in Berlin, yeah.
Berlin, that'd be
and
awesome.
The Chemnitz one as well.
Let's try and do one of those. I can translate for you.
Wow.
You haven't mentioned Libre Graphics this time.
There is Libre Graphics, yeah. I don't know where it's being held this year.
Is that normally in Europe? I mean, it was in Poland one year, wasn't it?
It's been in North America as well, hasn't it?
Oh, right, okay.
A few years ago it was Canada. Yeah. I don't know. But yeah, that is an important event. You're right.
Perhaps for a quick question to ask then for listeners for the comments is what more Linux events they would like.
Yeah.
What would you like, listeners, as well?
But do you remember in the 80s and 90s there was Amiga World? And I used to get so excited about going to Amiga World and do that kind of event. But it's just too big. It's too big scale that, the equivalent Linux World and in the world of open source is not at all like Amiga World. It's really corporate.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I never went to an Amiga World show, but I imagine it was full of hardware gadgets could actually take home with you, whereas you go to a big Linux show and it's all Unix enterprise data silo nonsense that tires us. And
yeah, if we were going to do something, it would have to be probably sponsored by Novell or
Canonical.
Some other...
Oh, no, we are sponsored.
We are sponsored by Canonical.
Already, Apple.
Let's get even... My God, can you imagine the hate mail we'd get if we? Oh dear!
No. I already get enough hate mail; it wouldn't make any difference to me. I want more hate mail. So send me hate mail, listeners.
Leave that one in the post then.
But yeah, it'd be great if there was a Linux show just like that. You know, lots of hardware. You know, presentations from open source developers for the KD project, the GNOME project, XFC, all the big application people, all there in one place.
I guess Fosdem's a bit like that. I went there. It was in Belgium a couple of years ago, and. I went along there, and there were like small stands for a lot of the niche OS projects like Haiku and Syllable. That was pretty cool.
That about means it's the end of...
One more thing.
Are we going to do the one more thing?
I've got a terrible cough there.
Are people going to realise that this is the one more thing?
I reintroduced the one more thing, and then somebody posted a comment saying...
Two people?
Bring back one more thing.
This is one more thing.
One more thing.
Wow. Interestingly, one person said on the comments, one more thing or die, which may be a death threat to me, but I'm pretty cool with that. So, So we were talking about Firefox before, and I want to test your geek levels once again to see just how much you know about Firefox.
Netscape.
So, what was Firefox called before it was called Firefox?
Phoenix.
Nope.
Ice Weasel.
Nope. Come on, you must know that.
Disraeli.
Graham was partially right, but directly before it was called Firefox, it was called...
Firebird.
Firebird, correct. Yeah, it was Phoenix and then Firebird. And then they got into a big argument with the Firebird database developers. And so they had to rebrand it again into Firefox. And can you remember, can you have a guess as to when Firefox 1.0 was released?
Tuesday.
Almost.
3 o'clock.
2005?
Pretty close. It was November the 9th, 2004. So... Yeah, it's been going for quite a while there. So thanks, Phoenix.
Hang on, you didn't give us a chance.
Oh, sorry, Effie.
I was just about to say that.
That exact day.
Exactly.
Well, that's great. I mean, looking forward to four.
Four, five, six, five, and seven this year.
Okay, well, that's the end of episode 3. Thanks for listening. Remember that... the magazine pays our wages if you
want
to
buy it. Please.
And we'll see you in a couple of weeks' time.
Bye-bye.
Adios.
Bye.